Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 370.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we look at our closet for the 500th time and think, oh my God, I really need to go through this, and you don't. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and I am endlessly thinking about reorganizing and getting rid of stuff. And today, we're actually going to talk about Marie Kondo, the icon of getting rid of stuff, and what her house looks like today. We'll also talk about the evolution of queer baiting, and we'll look at a couple whose level of party has changed over time. Today's panel is it's a dream. It's just a dream panel. I am joined by a columnist at the Boston Globe. She also has a new podcast called Say More with Shirley Leung. And it's named that way because we are, in fact, joined by the one and only Shirley Leung. Hey, Shirley.
Hey, Nagin. Thanks for having me. It's so exciting to be on your podcast.
Oh, so exciting to have you. And join us. You've heard her on the show before. She's just, just an incredible comedian, an incredible actor, an incredible writer. You've seen her just everywhere, being the icon that she is. And also, you can see her on tour with the Live and Livid show. She is probably coming to a city near you. It is the one and only Margaret Cho. Hey, Margaret.
Hi. Great to be back. Thank you.
So excited to have you. And before we get into the show, I just want to remind listeners that if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/NaginFarsad. And you get bonus episodes. We posted an episode about a guy who has rats for pets. And we really got into it. And there's a lot of thoughts about whether or not you should have a rat as a pet, never mind multiple rats. So these are the kind of gems you get at patreon.com/NaginFarsad. So go and subscribe. And I just also want to mention that we're recording this show very early. We don't do this because we try and kind of follow the news cycle. So you're going to get some stories that are kind of more generally from the cultural vault, but they are fantastic. And then don't worry, because next week, whatever happened, we'll discuss it. But you know what? Let's just hope nothing really happens, that it's just like a boring summer week and that we're all chilling. So let's get into it with topic number one. Okay, so you guys, Marie Kondo is messy now. She finds joy in a messy house, and she says keeping her home neat is no longer a priority now that she has three children. I mean, my first question is really, what the fuck? And do you feel betrayed? Because I sort of do. I don't know. Margaret, were you ever a Marie Kondoite? Did any of this, or did you ever aspire to be somewhere vaguely in the back of your mind but never did it?
I tried it. You know, I tried a little bit and I thought it was really helpful. And then it reminded me of how much junk I have and how much I am really an over-consumer. And so it did help me kind of assess like how much I hoard and do. But I also kind of got a little bit bored of it. I think I do like a bit of clutter. To me, it actually is very familiar and normal. I think my parents were such incredible neat freaks that it made me feel unsafe when everything was so neat and clean, because there was just such emotional chaos in my home.
Right.
So all of the mess, actually, you know, I'm the only person who lives in my house and I create the mess. So to me, it's not mess. It's just I put it there and I'm fine with it. But also, Marie Kondo has the right to her own life. She is really about whatever sparks joy. So her joy right now comes from the mess of her kids, which I think is great.
So Shirley, I bought the book, right? I bought the book when it came out and I read it. I followed it for, a couple weeks. You know, remember the part where she folds her underwear a special way? I mean, that mm-hmm. was kind of crazy. But I have to say, notice that in the stories about Marie Kondo being messy, there was no photographic evidence. Okay.
I didn't
see any photos of her messiness. And let's be clear. I mean, Marie Kondo's messiest day is my neatest. Okay. So, so I don't think I quite buy it that she's messy now. Maybe messy for her, but not for the rest of us.
Right. A friend of mine, like, moved into a new apartment and had people over, and it looked, you know, everything looked perfect. And then a couple months later, had people, the same people over. And one of them said, oh, like, your apartment looks, it looks great now. It looks a little lived in. And she was traumatized. Like, she does not want her place to look lived in at all. Like, she does want it to look like a museum piece, you know? And so I thought that was, you know, so I was like, but it still looked perfect, right? Everything still kind of like looked just so. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, her concept of a mess is so, and what embarrasses her is like, is the bar is so high. I mean, the rest of us, it couldn't possibly. So I think you're right. Marie Kondo's idea of a mess is different. This is what she said in the piece about it. She the coverage on it. We read something in the Washington Post. She wrote, she said, up until now, I was a professional tidier, so I did my best to keep my home tidy at all times. I've kind of given up on that in a good way for me. Now I realize what's important to me is enjoying spending time with my children at home. I think your assessment, Margaret, is really right on. Like, her thing was about the definition of joy, not necessarily. It's like, it's okay that her definition of joy has evolved.
Yeah. I mean, because it's also the point of her method is like, let's just keep around what makes us happy. And so that doesn't necessarily define what the space is going to look like to other people, you know? It's like her. I think the whole thing is like, let's only keep around our atmosphere what gives us happiness. And that's actually a really great way to look at life. Like then if there's things that we aren't happy about, or are there just a byproduct of laziness, that's another thing. That's something you can take away. But if everything about her life is making her happy, then she's actually fully living the Marie Kondo lifestyle still.
Yeah. I think your point about, like, what level of a consumer are you is really well taken, because that's something that, as you know, I feel like I go in these waves where I'm currently dealing with like a deadline that's just driving me crazy, and I'm just trying to get through this gig basically, and it's a writing deadline, and non-union, don't worry about it, and I'm not walking over any lines, and it's one of these things where I start to feel like some kind of stress or pressure, and then I kind of end up buying outfits as a result. You know what I mean? It's like my way of like handling. And then I'll be like, I don't need to buy these things. Yeah. I have so many clothes. What am I doing? You know, and I make excuses. Well, I perform and I need to wear a different outfit. Like, I cook up all these reasons. But it does, I start to feel like very bad about the kind of consumerism that, why is my consumerism also tied to making me, you know, feel better somehow, just giving me like some kind of a dopamine hit. Like, that's so sinister that my body does that. You know what I mean? Yeah.
You know, I stress buy a lot as well, especially, you know, I've had a hard week. Maybe I go online and I start to shop, put things, a lot of things in my cart. Maybe I won't buy them, but it makes me feel better. But, you know, one of the things that I was wondering about, you know, this whole thing about decluttering, I wonder if it changed during the pandemic, you know? I mean, I feel like you went one of two ways, right?
Okay.
One was like, you there was nowhere to go. So there were all these stories of, you didn't need Marie Kondo to tell you to clean out your house. A lot of people were doing it on their own, right? So suddenly you have a lot of people with very clean houses. And so they don't need to watch her show or buy any more of her books, right? So, and then other people just embrace their messiness. I mean, we in my household, we did both, you know, because we didn't have people coming over. You know, I have two little kids. We didn't have any house guests. We didn't entertain. So we let ourselves go. I mean, it was like Grey Gardens. I mean, we had just stuff piled up on the dining room table. You know, we're all, you know, two people working from home, you know, kids for some time were, you know, at schooled at home. So it was a huge mess. And I think maybe in 2022, we realized we need some help. We need to do something here. So we actually rented a dumpster. And we just cleaned out our house. I mean, it's still not clean. We only got through, I think, the basement and the garage, and that was it. But we spent $600 getting a, you know, renting a dumpster and just cleaning out. I mean, now we want to do it again. We have enough stuff. I mean, we haven't cleaned out stuff in 10 years. We still have like baby strollers, and my kids are 10 and 12.
Oh my God. Well, see, that's the problem. This is a uniquely other parts of the country, other than New York City problem, because we have just this one little space for a stroller, and we're like at the point basically where we can get rid of it. We're just like waiting for the summer to end, and then we're going to give it away. But like in New York City, you can't be too like committed to anything.
You can't be a hoarder.
You just cannot be a hoarder in New York City, not with this square footage. Like I have friends that keep all the artwork of their kids, like, you know, every day they come home with artwork or whatever from elementary school. And I'm like, how is that even possible? Like they make such a ridiculous amount of just shit. And, you know, after you've gotten a bunch of squiggly lines, you know, once you kind of get it. You kind of get it for the age group, you know. So I think but I like the idea that like the pandemic kind of made people embrace a maybe messier life. Or in, I think some cases, it's sort of like what the pandemic did with what some people like lost a ton of weight, but then some people gained a ton of weight. It was like
right.
Your response to the thing had this, you know, this variance. Margaret, did you have any like shifts of tidiness from the pandemic?
I think what it made me realize is like how much I mindlessly buy, because will look at social media. I'll buy things off of social media. Like, and I really had to make a hard like rule for myself is to only purchase things that were just like very distinctly sustainable, which made them a lot more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about clothing mostly.
Yeah.
Or things that were vintage or secondhand, and also things that were reimagined, so reworked.
Right.
And that actually cut my buying quite a lot when I wasn't purchasing things that, not necessarily even fast fashion, but things that were just new. So I had so much of a backlog of like old fast fashion, old things that were new, old things that just didn't have that same kind of value. So now I do spend more on clothing, but I buy less overall.
I feel like that's the shift that happened with me in general, because my little rule is I basically only buy things in person at stores.
Wow.
So I support.
Great. That's great.
So
like that's a good rule.
I've never heard of that one. Because also it's more fun. Like it is more fun. And also you don't end up like getting a thing that doesn't fit or whatever.
Right.
Like you just work all that stuff out of the store. Like it's just, I'm very old fashioned that way. But it also means that I just don't, it's like I don't mindlessly do the thing. And I talked about it on the show before, where I was once conned into like buying a thing off of Instagram, and it just was the most embarrassing product, and it arrived, and I was just like, what was I thinking? This thing, it was like tights that are supposed to for the winter, that are supposed to look, this is so embarrassing, that are supposed to look like you're wearing pantyhose. Okay, but they're like,
oh yeah.
And it's, I was like, why am I even, who cares if it looks like I'm wearing tights or pantyhose? You know what I mean? What am I doing? And the whole, that actually created a, a rift in the space-time continuum for me, that purchase, where like, and then I was just like in a different timeline after that, where I was like, I'm never going back to that other timeline. I can't do it. It's so embarrassing. Okay, folks, tell me, what are your thoughts on Marie Kondo and her evolution? Have you joined her in this evolution? Were you ever a Kondoite? I'm so curious. Hit me up. And in the meantime, we're going to take a quick break so we can hear about our sponsors, and then we're going to come back. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back and we're ready for topic number two. So, I guess we're kind of getting used to queer baiting when it comes to celebrities. People like Harry Styles have been accused of being in this camp. Maybe they're redefining manhood for themselves. I don't know. But the pressure on celebrities seems to have increased. So first of all, let's describe what queer baiting is and talk about how it's kind of ramped up in recent months and years.
It's gay cosplay in order to pick up the instruments of gayness in order to almost sharpen your sense of heterosexuality. Like, I am so secure in my heterosexuality that I can play gay and use it as this artifice, as a way to strike my heteronormativity into relief. There's a reflective quality about it, but also I think it's beautiful. Like, actually really enjoy it. I love the androgyny of rock in general, and I've always appreciated it. So I don't know if it's so much a negative thing, but I guess it is that we as queers so hunger for representation that is meaningful and that is not necessarily performative, but in queer baiting, it lends to that. So it's I think it's a really complex issue. It's a little bit like a new school way of looking at outing. Like outing was a very controversial thing in like the Y2K era. Right. When you're talking about celebrity and who's gay and who's not, and you know, that outing of people was actually a very controversial idea. There's a lot of radical gay theory was about, well, you should be outing people because they should be absolutely proud to be gay. And that you need to force them into this role. And that necessarily wasn't productive or appropriate in the time or even now. So it's complicated. I like queerbaiting, but I can see where it has a certain population offended.
It's the weaponization of queerbaiting that's the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and people using it, I guess, making people feel uncomfortable, I guess in the case of actors, right, or actors or musicians, people who are, I guess, in the spotlight, I mean, forcing them to kind of, you know, out themselves or declare their sexuality. I mean, that's the bad part of it, right? And I agree with Margaret. I mean, it's so great that, you know, that people, people, you know, queers can be represented and can be, you know, seen as part of the mainstream, you know, versus, you know, being forced to be outed, you know, which I think was horrible. I mean, not that long ago. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's 20, 30 years ago. People, you know, you might not be able to get you might not be able to make it in Hollywood, right? If you were gay. And so now it's embraced, but I think you have to do it on your own. I think someone's sexual orientation, it's, they own it. They should be able to decide when they tell the world or not. Right.
Right. And there's a Vice piece that we looked at for this, and it talked about a young celebrity like Kit Connor, who was the star of Heartstopper, and he felt forced to come out, and he recently posted something saying, quote, "I'm bi. Congrats for forcing an 18-year-old to out himself." And in that situation, it felt like, I wonder, like, what kind of choices did he have, if any, in that kind of pressuring situation? And I also wonder if the pressuring felt different generationally. Like, I wonder if an 18-year-old, like, you know, 25 years ago would have felt the same pressure as this 18-year-old who's probably terminally online, you know, feels today. Mm-hmm. You know, what did you make of that, of this kind of forced outing?
It's interesting because it's like also up to question. The unsaid thing is, do we think it's okay if people who are straight playing queer characters? So that's what's not being said underneath it all. And I think it's really kind of, I would rather see a queer actor play a queer role. That's kind of always going to be my impetus in general, as I think just to have witnessed cinema for so long, it's like, okay to show our stories, but we can't even play ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this also goes for Asian.
Right, this happened to Asian Americans,
well.
Right? We were often played by white actors.
White people, by Scarlett Johansson. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's just like the same sort of thing. So, but underneath it all, it's like, well, we now are looking to actually diversify cinema and make it so that, you know, these actors are given the opportunity. So that's kind of, I think, what's underneath it all.
And then is the, what about a queer actor playing a straight person? Where do you?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, they should. Why not? You know, I think absolutely, because that's totally a role, and it's bought, you buy it. You know, if I want an actor to be good too. So I think it's just like, I'm going to believe it.
Right.
And as a queer person, we often have to take on heteronormative roles in society, in life. It's a way that we can be perceived to have a right to exist, so many of us. So I think, yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because, like, I wasn't around for the David Bowie phenomenon of the whatever that, whenever that was, the 70s. But I wonder, it, like, it's funny because I don't know what the discourse was around it, but was he queer baiting, or was he just a guy with, like, expansive taste? You know what I mean? That was just sort of like,
I think both.
Right.
Both. I think both are true. I think that he was queer baiting as not necessarily a way to convey his own desires, but then his own desires followed that too. So I think they're both things. I think queer baiting for him was a way to show how transgressive he was as an artist, not necessarily conforming to anything other than, like, it is like he really was the alien, that he was a Ziggy. So I don't know how it is sort of perceived now. David Bowie is sort of like very picked apart and looked at culturally, but the time was so flexible. The 70s was really interesting because there was so much about sexuality that was really being redefined that we can't even imagine the openness.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like now also where there's this kind of wave of, I don't know, there's like gender fluidity, almost sexual orientation fluidity that's happening. So kind of the lines are being blurred all around. And I mean, I thought Margaret, you know, I didn't even think about, you know, should, you know, LGBT actors and actresses, should they be playing, you know, gay characters and lesbian characters? You're right. There probably should be, because they probably don't get enough jobs. They aren't represented enough. And it seems to me they should get those jobs, and they should not be played by straight people, or as much as possible, be played by straight people.
Mm-hmm. I think it adds, like, an actor's queerness adds to the role, but also because we're forced to act in society as hetero for so much of our time.
That's right.
That we'd be appropriate in the other role as well.
I also, it's interesting, like, I wonder about, like, the response. Sometimes I feel like, you know, I think about when, like, I'm not a celebrity. If anything, I'm just like a occasionally known public radio personality. So, like, it's like a very different set of pressures. But, you know, because of my work in with the Muslim community, and, like, you know, making movies like The Muslims Are Coming, and in my last book or whatever, I did get attacked on far right publications. And this is different from queer baiting, obviously, but the attack feeling is similar, because I would be in Breitbart, or I would be in Daily Caller or something, and they would call me an Islamofascist, and they would start articles, Nagin Farsad, Islamofascist, whatever. And then, so then that they would basically send an army of then people that would tweet at me. I would go on conservative talk radio as an effort to bridge the gap or whatever. And by and large, that was a positive experience, but in some cases I would get an army of people who would then, you know, just attack me for days. They would attack me on Twitter, Facebook, or whatever. And my response was either to ignore them or to write back, like, you know, thanks so much for, like, visiting my Twitter page or whatever. Like, I would just say something that was just, like, friendly and kind of boring, like, that they didn't, it's like, what? And then they would try and be like, yeah, well, you're a libtard or whatever. And I'd be like, thank you so much again for taking the time to respond. Like, and they would just get bored and they would just leave me alone. Yeah. And so part of me is a little bit like, do these, the people that are attacking and, like, need to know if Kit Connor is bisexual or not, whatever, like, it, part of me is like, I don't know, could you do the like Nagin Farsad method? Would it work with the right wing bigots, and just, like, ignore, because it's way less interesting for them if they can't get a rise out of you and they can't get it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, again, I don't know what it's like. Obviously, like, this kid was in a more higher profile show, but still, I think there's, like, something about tactic here and that the need for everybody to always respond to a thing online. And I feel like, just don't. I mean, why do you, you know what I mean?
Right. For a long time, before social media, if you came under attack, you probably wouldn't respond. I mean, it's again, part of this culture of kind of oversharing, overreacting or something, you know? And so, Nagin, ignore your trolls.
Yeah.
You're way too nice.
Yeah, well, when I felt, it's funny because I would, when I had the time or whatever, I would like write the nice responses, but then, when the volume was too much, there was a time for like a full week or something, like I could not go on Twitter because it was just too overrun with that stuff. And when the volume became too much, I was just like, well, I just have to wait this out, you know, and then I'll go back to Twitter in a week or something when it's all done. But I do think there's like a weird, it's like you kind of can in some way, and I mean, Margaret, you probably have a lot to say about this, like define the type of celebrity you, I wonder, can you control the kind of celebrity that you are, like what kind of access you give to fandom? Like, what is your, you know, relationship to fandom, basically?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not really sure exactly because I was really bombarded with a lot of trolling in the very dawn of the internet, the dawn of trolling in like 2003. So, you know, I had made disparaging remarks about the Bush administration, which now I realize I apologize to George W. Bush. He wasn't that bad. Not
in comparison.
In comparison to what we have now.
You didn't know.
I wish we could have them back again. You know what? They were great. All of the Bushes. But back then, I was really critical of it. And then I got really a lot of crazy trolling. And I was really upset, you know, and I would feel like I'd have to remark on it and I have to do something about it. And then nowadays, I really don't even seek out anybody who even vaguely disagrees because I just am so sensitive. I'm like so overly sensitive by I think my own trial by fire in the beginning of it. And I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to fight with anybody because I already know what I know and nothing's going to change my mind. I get really protective of my own peace that way. So I kind of hold it at bay to an extent.
And also, you know, we're all women of color here. And I mean, there have been studies shown that, you know, at least women of color, I mean, journalists in particular, we're attacked more. We at the Globe and I'm sure in other newsrooms too, we go through training on how to deal with social media, how to deal with the trolls. And they actually, they're split on whether or not you should quote unquote feed the trolls. And so I've just, and then sometimes it's better to have, I mean, you shouldn't respond. You know, the person who's under attack should not respond, but maybe their allies respond, you know, on their behalf. And I remember sitting in this one session where, a white male colleague is like, when I write, I never get this kind of reaction on social media compared to my, you know, women, my female colleagues, in particular, my female colleagues of color. They're the ones that are treated brutally online. And I mean, it's really a reflection of society, right? I mean, what happens online? I mean, we also, face a lot of trauma and discrimination in real life. So it's an extension of that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true because I've done a lot of guest hosting for different like radio things, whatever. And I'll get like hate mail about my voice, right? But then the male people that, you know, friends of mine that also guest host for the same thing won't get the hate mail.
You're so great, right? That'll be the reaction.
I'll get a lot of you're so great and all that. Yeah. So I get a lot of that, but I also will get a little hate mail. And it's funny because a younger comic did a thing and she was like, I know you did this thing. Did you get hate mail for it? And I was like, yeah, totally. And she's like, oh, phew. I thought I was the only one. I was like, no. You and literally every woman, but like give it, but it's decreased in over time. I don't get as much as I did when I start with, you know, when my faceless voice started hitting airwaves. And so I think it's just a matter of like getting people used to this octave in this range. but like eventually, you know what I mean? So I feel like in so many ways, I feel like it's funny you mentioned the 70s were such a crazy time. I feel like we're almost like doing this crazy time again, where we're in the flux and everyone's like yelling, and we probably have more yelling than they did in the 70s, but there's a lot more range of art and people that we're seeing. And so and it's like this kind of this guinea pig phase. We're all trying to figure it out, and then I think 5 years from now, like, these conversations will probably, I'm going to say optimistically, we're going to just all have it settled. It'll be a real utopia in 5 years.
That's a good timeline.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's stick to it, folks. Let us now move on to topic number three. So, okay, we read a letter in the advice column in Slate titled, "My husband still wants me to be the party animal from our youth. I'm not a part of that scene anymore." And let me just read you her question. She said, I've changed and my husband hasn't. We have two kids, 11 and 7. Our 11-year-old has autism, and caring for him takes a lot of time and energy, not to mention trying to balance love and attention for my 7-year-old. And I don't mind it at all. I love being a mother, but my husband keeps accusing me of being done with him now that I had our children. I want to do family things, and he wants the carefree partying version of me before we had children. And the fact is, I don't enjoy the scene anymore. Drugs and alcohol throw off my equilibrium. I have bipolar disorder. I've done it occasionally for his benefit, but I'm miserable. I don't mind if he does that stuff with a friend. I'd much rather stay home with the kiddos. He's unhappy, and I don't think I should have to change or regress to please him. Is our marriage over? So let us address this woman's problem. Margaret, do you think this marriage is over?
I don't think the marriage is over. I think it's just got to be really reassessed in a way of that, like, why is he so stuck in trying to bring back the partying years? That's a really kind of a not a good place to be in as you get older, I think. I mean, I think there's ways to do it that's responsible and that is something that can capture that. But, you know, to me, I think it's, I don't know. I don't think that's appropriate for anybody that's getting older. I think we can definitely have fun, but it's just weird for somebody who wants to stay there.
Yeah. Especially and they have a family. You know what I mean? It's like he's also a parent. So I feel like that's so odd.
It's not odd because I'm living this right now.
What?
What's going on is midlife crisis. This is a man going through midlife crisis. My husband and I were in our early 50s. I also have a 10-year-old. We have a 10-year-old and 12-year-old. We have a 12-year-old also on the autism spectrum.
Oh, my God. Did you write this letter?
I didn't write it. I swear to God, I didn't write it. And it's really interesting because this year, my husband's gone on this kick. He wants to go to all these concerts now because all the I guess we're Gen X, and all the people that we grew up listening to are still on tour, and the tickets are really affordable. You know, they're not like Taylor Swift, like, you know, $1,500.
Right. Like you can get the ticket.
You can get the tickets, and they're like $55. Actually, the babysitting bill is more expensive than the tickets. You know, and so I can't. I've seen more concerts, or about to see more concerts, than I have in my entire life. We saw Steve Miller. I mean, he's like 79. He was really good. Mm. We saw the Counting Crows. We're seeing Amy Mann. We're actually going on vacation in L.A., where you are, Margaret, and we're going to see Amy Mann at Greek Theater. You know, even on vacation, we're going to concerts. We're seeing Van Morrison, and then I think the Eagles. We got tickets to the – he was stressed. He's like, should we get tickets to the Eagles? I was like, if you can get them I guess I'll go with you. But that's the other thing. You know, he doesn't have a lot of, you know, as men get older, some of them don't have a lot of friends. You know, they really just, their friends, are, right? And so suddenly I feel out of obligation. I have to go to these concerts with them. So I'm going to all, so, I mean, I feel a little bit of like a party pooper because all I can think about is like, oh, I gotta do the logistics of the kids, and I've gotta, if we go see a concert here, I gotta get a hotel. I'm like, this is too much, but I'm humoring him and going to these concerts, not making him find someone else or go alone.
I love concerts though. That's a little bit different than
partying,
doing drugs,
yeah,
and partying. Like, to me, concerts are really, I go to them all the time, and I will probably always go to them. So that's not necessarily what I imagine as this like partying.
Well,
atmosphere.
I guess to me, like I'm such a, like, I'm so into my work, you know, I'm so into my family that it is akin to partying.
Yeah.
Going to a concert is akin to being
for
a party animal for me, you know?
For sure.
But
for
I do think there's something about, like, dudes, you know, like my husband has friends, but like he doesn't see them as much. Like I actually like really make it a point to see my friends. I do not get from him what I get from my friends. I do need to see my friends. And I think that's part of the issue here is like, this guy needs to feel young, but it has to be with his wife. Like, can you not go feel young with one of your boys? And then, like, you know what I mean? If you have to do drugs, like, I don't know. There's like, I think there's like arrangements that can happen. Like, you don't have to get all of those feelings from one person.
And just because I don't think the marriage, back to that, the column, whatever, I don't think the marriage is over. I do feel that they just have to set expectations, you know, and maybe not go back to partying days, but maybe get out. I mean, you know, it can be when your kids are that age, it's been a decade from diapers to middle school. And for the often all the a lot of the childcare responsibility falls on the wife, and so we're just in the thick of things. We're in survival mode, right? We're in charge of the school, all the, you know, school, and also doctor's appointments. I mean, we almost don't have time for anything else. I mean, that's what I see is going on in this marriage.
But
you
also,
know?
Even regardless of even if you have kids, like all of my single friends who are like in their late 30s or 40s, don't drink as much, don't do as many drugs because their bodies just can't snap back the way they used to. So I don't know. I have some weird advice for her, which is like, why don't you do it for a week? Like, and he'll be like, oh my God, this sucks. I have headaches. Like, I can't wake up. I can't, you know what I mean? Like, your body doesn't snap back from drugs and alcohol the way it used to. I think for like most people, I don't know, Margaret's like, no, my body is great. She's looking at me skeptically.
No, I mean, I just think it's really like, don't even do it. Like, I'm like, oh, it's such a weird waste.
It's
like, drugs are never that fun. And they're not, I mean, as you get older, it's just worse and worse. But a midlife crisis is like, they want danger. They want excitement. Right. So maybe there's other ways of seeking that are not necessarily partying.
It's funny because my cousin did, I get for his midlife crisis, he bought some motorcycles. And that he would, also he would like practice them or whatever on a track or something. He actually had an accident on the track. And luckily, I mean, I can laugh about it now, but it was like very terrible, this accident. And then he was in
the
hospital for days.
Is he still on a motorcycle? He's totally fine.
Yeah, everything's fine. But it was like questionable for a minute. You know what I mean? We were all very worried. And but it is like a danger thing that he needed. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I would love to just help these guys out. And I don't know, is there other... Can you do like a rock climbing wall at a gym and get some thrills? Like, I don't know. Something with like a padded landing. Maybe haven't gotten there. And I also just think like midlife crises don't strike women in the same way. I don't like have very many female friends that are like having the same inclinations. I don't know. That's obviously like a very gendered generalization. So who knows? But I don't
know. I like your idea of just one all-nighter, one party night and see what happens. You're right. I think if the couple's older, I think he'll realize that I'm not as young and I can't do this anymore. And then that will be it, because it seems like he has an itch to scratch.
Right. And mm-hmm. also he's probably, I mean, we didn't get the sense from this letter, but I imagine he's like a decent father, or like a loving father. He cares about his kids. If he has like to do whatever 15 errands that are kid related the next day with that hangover, right? I mean, what are we even talking about here?
Horrible.
So maybe she front loads his to-do list. You know what I mean? Goes on a bender, and then the next day he has to do these 15 things. None of them get done, and the children end up staying home from school. That's my recommendation, folks. What do you think? Is their marriage doomed, or do they have many more merry years to come? I think they have merry years to come. They put in the work. They'd be out.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, and that, my friends, is the end of the show. The two of you are just so utterly fantastic, and I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you in all the wonderful things that you do. Margaret Cho, where do they do that, and remind us of your tour?
My tour is called Live and Livid, and you can get tickets on margaretcho.com. I'll probably be coming to where you are, so check it out. You can find me on Twitter at Margaret Cho, on Instagram at Margaret_Cho, and on TikTok at The Margaret Cho.
Folks, go to this show. If you've never seen Margaret Cho live, it should be a part of your summer plans, a part of your fall plans, however long this tour lasts. It's such a delight. It's such a joy. Shirley Leung, where do people find you?
Yes, I am write a column for the Boston Globe. I'm also the host of Say More with Shirley Leung. It's a half hour show. When you think of Boston, we have big thinkers, big innovators, but I don't have the chance to talk to them. And so this is my chance to talk to the biggest thinkers and innovators. And it's, you can find the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Folks, get to the subscribing button on your podcast machine for Shirley Leung's show. It sounds phenomenal. And you know where to find me and all things that I do. And just as a reminder, I think by the time this airs, I may be I'll be in St. Paul on August 18th and Kansas City on August 19th. I think this will be airing right before that. So yes, so you could still get tickets as part of the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me stand-up tour. And then on August 24th, I'll be in Chicago doing a regular Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. So join me for that if you're in Chicago. And then I'll be coming back at you with some fall stuff that's going on. And I want to thank everyone who makes the show a possibility. That's our fantastic producer, Andrew McGuire. Thanks to everyone at HeadGum. And thank you to Gabby Alter for our theme music. You can email us at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com to send us any ideas you have. Also, we're getting back to Races to Watch. That's electoral contests to watch. So hit me up with any of those. And we will be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.